Hi again, everybody. I'm Dan Hoard, and thanks for downloading the Bengals Booth Podcast, the With Arms Wide Open edition, as we speak to a guy that the Bengals certainly hope will be wide open for many years to come, second-round draft pick T. Higgins. Then, after I chat with T., it's 45 quality minutes with my broadcast partner Dave Lapham, including a new round of Ask Lap questions that you submitted on Twitter. The Bengals Booth Podcast is presented by Prime Sport, the official fan travel and hospitality partner of the Cincinnati Bengals. And here's a quick reminder that you can have the latest edition of this podcast delivered right to your phone, tablet, or computer by subscribing on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or Podbean. It's the greatest thing since Peyton's Places. Last year, future Hall of Fame quarterback Peyton Manning hosted a 30-episode documentary series in conjunction with a celebration of the NFL's 100th season. The series looks at key moments in NFL history through conversations with former players, coaches, and other key figures. I've only recently started watching Peyton's Places on ESPN+, and they are awesome! Manning is extremely likable as a host, and his appreciation for the history of the game shines through in every episode. You have to pay for a subscription to watch on ESPN+, but I've noticed that ESPN has been running episodes for free on its various channels due to the absence of live sporting events. So, if you don't have ESPN+, I recommend searching for Peyton's Places and setting up your DVR to record any episodes that run on TV. I promise you won't be sorry. Now, let's get to this week's guests. My first conversation this week is with the Bengals' second-round draft pick, T. Higgins, the 6'4", 216-pound wide receiver out of Clemson with great hands and a ridiculous catch radius thanks to his 81-inch wingspan. Higgins was the seventh wide receiver taken in what was considered to be one of the deepest pools of wide receivers in the history of the NFL draft, and the Bengals obviously hope that he will be one of Joe Burrow's top targets for many years to come. T, we learned on draft night that you are a Bengals fan and an A.J. Green fanatic. 4 years ago, you tweeted, "I will meet A.J. Green one day." Have you had any contact with A.J. since the draft?
We've talked a couple times over the phone, but I haven't met him in person yet, nah.
Were those phone conversations interesting?
It was just, more of a congratulations and, can't wait to get to work type phone call, so it wasn't too much.
We're chatting with T. Higgins. A.J. is your favorite wide receiver, but you will wear the uniform number of another Bengals legend, Chad Johnson. Did I read correctly that you reached out to Chad about wearing 85?
Yeah, I definitely did. Just out of respect, what he's done with the for the organization, and I just wanted to reach out to him before I even, told the equipment guys that I wanted to wear 85. Obviously, I wanted to keep my college number. Was in my number, whether it was either 15 or 85. 15 was already taken, so 85 was the only other option. But, I had to ask him, and he was okay with it.
It sounds like he was more than okay with it. He tweeted basically that he's honored that you wanted to wear it.
Just something that I gotta keep the tradition going with that number, so hopefully I can.
T, you were born in 1999, 2 years before Chad was drafted. How much do you know about his NFL career?
I just know he was, what they say, you can't guard 85, so... And he was real quick with his feet. He was just unguardable.
Ironically, you have trained with his former college and NFL teammate T.J. Houshmandzadeh, who recommended you to Bengals scouts. What were some of the biggest things you took away from training with T.J.?
Just the basic stuff, really. The top of routes, releases, and really the knowledge of the game. He's a really great guy. And he's a great coach. And, I look forward to working with him in the future more and more. So,
we're chatting with T. Higgins. What's your schedule like these days?
Obviously we have, team meetings and stuff. But, other than that, I'm on the field or, in a workout room getting my grind on. That's what I do best. and just working on my craft, trying to get better and better each and every day.
What's been the best part of those team Zoom meetings?
Just getting to meet all my new teammates, you know, all my new coaches, and really just learning a new playbook.
Where you're living, have you been able to do football activities?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we have a few quarterbacks out here and a few gyms that's open now. So definitely have that.
How much interaction have you had with Joe since the draft?
You know, we've talked a few times. We talk over Zoom, you know, so we've been talking.
What did it mean to UT when Joe was among the first NFL quarterbacks to show his support for the black community after the death of George Floyd?
You know, it means a lot. You know, just a guy with his platform, you know, he's just showing that he really cares and that this is the guy that is showing his true colors.
You faced him and LSU in the national championship game last year. What stood out about his performance in that game?
You know, he's a guy that's never going to give up. It was obviously up on him. And, you know, you can see that he plays with poise. And he brought his team back and, you know, won the biggest game in college.
Have you set any goals for your rookie year?
Definitely. You know, obviously, every rookie wants to be rookie of the year. But, you know, that's one of my goals. And really just go out there and just, you know, help my team come out with a better season than we did, you know, the past few years, and just contribute the best way I can.
You were the first pick of the second round, number 33 overall, but I read that you have a bit of a chip on your shoulder from not being selected in the first. Is that accurate?
You can say that, but, you know, with me, I just wanted to be drafted no matter where I went, but, you know, I can use that as a chip on my shoulder, so I guess that's what I'm going to do.
TJ Houshmandzadeh was a seventh-round pick, and I remember that he used to be able to recite every wide receiver selected before him in the NFL draft. Are you motivated by the guys that were selected ahead of you?
You know, I know those guys really well because, you know, I'm real good friends with them. But, you know, those guys deserve to be when they got picked, and I'm happy for them. And, you know, so that's how I go about it.
T, when I watch footage of you at Clemson, I see you running away from defenders, but you didn't run a great 40-yard dash time before the draft. Did you have an injured hamstring?
I wasn't 100% running that, but, you know, there's no excuses. So, I mean, you guys see my game film. The Bengals organization trusted me, and they believe in me, so they're going to get the 100% to you again, so.
Jerry Rice ran a 4.71 40, and he's the best wide receiver of all time. Michael Thomas ran a 4.57, and he might be the best current wide receiver. Do we put too much emphasis on the 40-yard dash?
Yeah, I really don't think, you know, because a lot of football guys don't run track, so they have like 2-3 months to get their stance and starts right. So, I mean, 40 time really don't matter to me. Obviously, the organizations want to see if you're fast or not, but, you know, your game film is just takes you to a whole nother level, you know, so because it's actually competition on the field with you, and you can see how you separate from defenders and stuff like that. So,
how eager are you to get up to Cincinnati and have some sort of practicing with your teammates?
Can't wait. So it's going to be fun. Just can't wait to go out there and compete with those guys.
Hey, we're looking forward to seeing you here. Congratulations on a tremendous college career, and I look forward to meeting you in person soon.
Thank you.
T had 59 catches for 1,167 yards and 13 touchdowns at Clemson last year. And according to Pro Football Focus, Higgins is probably the most complete big wide receiver we've seen come into the league in quite some time. Before we get to Dave Lapham, here's a quick reminder that you can take your Bengals pride to the next level in 2020 with an official Bengals fan package from Prime Sport. I'm posting this podcast on Friday, June 5th, the first day that NFL coaches have been allowed back into their team facilities since mid-March when the league shut things down due to the coronavirus. Zach Taylor and most of his staff were back at Paul Brown Stadium on Friday morning. A few coaches are still out of town and will return next week. It's a hopeful sign that the league will be able to begin on schedule this season. And that was my first topic of conversation this week with my broadcast partner, Dave Lapham.
Lap, it's the first week of June. How confident are you that there will be an NFL season?
Well, I'm confident there'll be an NFL season in some way, shape, or form. You know, I'm not confident that the early stages of it will be played in front of crowds. And if it is played in front of crowds, that they'll be sparse, to say the least. And I just wonder about the preseason. I mean, it would not surprise me, would not shock me if they lost a couple of preseason games in the process of all this and had a couple of preseason games to tune up and get ready for the season. And, you know, at that point you wonder, does it even make sense to have 90 guys in training camp? I mean, how are you going to be able to make a true evaluation? You haven't been able to watch them in OTAs and mini camps, where you make your first and probably most important decision on guys on the field, watching them run, watching them, do they take proper angles, are they coachable, and you know, do you think they have a chance? And then it's solidified by action in the games. But a lot of times, you know, decisions are made on guys during OTAs and mini camps. A good percentage decision is made there, and they're absent this season. So it's going to be very, very tough for guys that you know, are just coming out of college and haven't transitioned to the NFL at all, and you're trying to decide, can they? And you don't really have a measuring stick. You know, signing veteran free agents, you already know that, all right, I get tape of them, I can see how they performed at the NFL level, but not so with the college kids.
You mentioned the possibility of games being played in front of no fans or a limited number of fans, particularly early in the season. How much would that negate home field advantage?
Tremendously, you know, you know, I guess you try to take every advantage you possibly can. And when the schedule first came out, I mean, four of the first six games for the Bengals are on the road, and you know, in boisterous places, vociferous crowds, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Indianapolis, and the Dome. Those are the four road games in their first six games of the season. Well, you know, if there are limited crowds or no crowd at all, man, that's a big difference maker, particularly offensively. I mean, that's where, you know, you have to go with silent counts and hand signals, and there's no verbal communication, and you know, there's a real good chance for false starts and guys not being on the same page and all those kind of things when you're in those environments. And I've been in those environments. It is very difficult. You eliminate the reason that it becomes difficult in those environments, that being the rabid fan base, man, all of a sudden what could have been a difficult start seems to be a lot easier with respect to the conditions and environment that you're playing in.
Would you enjoy being able to hear everything being said on the field as an announcer?
I would, because I remember back in the day there was a lot of stuff being said. Some of it you could hear and some of it you couldn't, but that would be interesting. And you know, a lot of it would obviously be X-rated. You know, it'd have to be for mature audiences only. That would be the problem that I could see is some of these young kids' heroes just cussing up a blue streak. You know, it's like mom and dad are like, you know, we don't want the. You can respect athletes, but don't make them your heroes. Well, if they listen to one football game, they may not be as big a hero as they might have been before they listened to them participate in that football game. Because, I mean, it's obviously raw and emotional, and, you know, a lot of things are said, that's for sure. But it would be interesting, you know, and you'd really have to, I think, it would add an extra burden to both sides of the football in terms of changing signals every week, because you get a tape of that game, and you just take the TV tape and you get all the audio, and you can match up linemen's configuration, blitzes to calls, you know, that guys are making and adjustments they're making and audibles they're making and all that sort of thing, and that makes it very interesting. That makes it very intriguing. So, you know. That might add another layer to preparation during the course of the week, you know, not having the same trigger, the same color keyword that, you know, right after I say in my cadence, the live color this week is black. Well, the following week it's orange. The week after that it's going to be white. The week after that it's going to be purple. And, you know, you have to change it up for sure, because teams will get a beat on it. No doubt about that with with having no crowd noise to impede what they might be hearing on the audio part of their tape.
It seems like a strong possibility at this point that there isn't going to be an off-season program, that the first time the teams practice together would be training camp. If that's the case, is there a position group that would suffer the most, or a particular type of player that would suffer the most from no off-season program?
Well, I think the young player obviously would probably suffer the most trying to make that jump to the National Football League. I can remember, and back in 1974 when I was a rookie, Dan, we only had like a 4-week quote mini camp as such after the draft. Then there was nothing until training camp. Now, mind you, training camp was 9 weeks long. It was ridiculous. There were 6 preseason games, right after the 4th of July. We were in Wilmington College until, it seemed like Labor Day. I mean, it was crazy. After Labor Day, it was nuts. But guys literally played themselves into shape. So this dynamic, the way the guys take care of themselves year-round, guys don't necessarily have off-season jobs like veteran players had to have back then, and work out at lunchtime and try to catch a workout and keep yourself in shape and nutrition. And I mean, it's such a different game now than it was back then. But I do think that they'll show that, okay, just if you get to training camp and get plenty of reps and somehow schedule practices where you try to catch up on reps, that's the thing that you're missing, is the physical repetition. Repetition breeds comfort level. You can talk till you're blue in the face about when this defensive end penetrates and this tackle loops around him, all right, right tackle, you got to stop the penetrator, make sure you stop him, pass him off to your guard, and then, take a drop step and take the looper. And you can talk about that all you want until you go out there and do it physically and get some kind of muscle memory and a repetition of doing it over and over again, because tackles set differently. One guy you're working with might set a little deeper than the other guy who sets more shallow at the line of scrimmage. You have to get a feel for all of your teammates. And that's why I think offensive line play, Dan, honestly, it's the biggest number of players in a position group. There are 5 players. And I always talk about, solid offensive line players, like making a fist becomes an involuntary reaction. You curl 4 fingers and wrap your thumb, and you don't even think about it. It's just involuntary. Well, when an offensive line has been working together and understands each other and all the repetitions, all the muscle memory, all the being on the same page mentally, that's how it plays. It's almost like making a fist, but when it's not, then if one's disjointed, you can't make a strong fist. And the line play suffers, as a result of that, from an analogy there. So, it's that position group takes a lot of repetition, camaraderie, understanding each other, in the meeting room, on the football field, even more so than in the meeting room. I mean, so I'd say offensive line play is a big, big part of it. And, quarterbacks and receivers, obviously timing things out. It's sometimes you'll see receivers that quarterback throws the football. It's like, why? How did he know to throw it there? And when he threw it and how he threw it and where he put it? Well, it's because they've done it a million times. And, if you haven't had that luxury, that all of it's going to suffer a little bit. It'll be interesting to see how quickly, guys can come up to speed and make the game look. I'm not saying the game's going to look terrible, but if there's only a couple of preseason games, if they go to training camp later and there are a couple of preseason games and they get into start of the regular season, it's going to take a while, a little bit, before the product gets up to what, up to snuff to what people are used to seeing, so many years in quality NFL line play and football in general.
Do you think it's important for Joe Burrow to get together with the wide receivers before training camp?
I do. You look at 2011, though, that was such an aberration and such a, a difference. That was a lockout. So Andy Dalton couldn't get together with his teammates. The first time you get together is, when they basically called practices, they basically, I shouldn't say couldn't get together, because Andrew Whitworth, Domantas Peckel, those guys put together practices, offense against defense, and I think that was very, very instrumental, very, very major in Andy Dalton, you know, being ready when training camp unfolded. You know, he's a very intelligent guy, Andy is, and he picked up the offense very quickly. The word is Joe Burrow is at least that, and maybe more. I mean, he's a Mensa. He's a football savant. He picks things up extremely quickly. But again, the physical repetition, you know, you can talk about it. You can talk about and look at tape and say, oh, yeah, when the safety does this, you know, you have to look here. Or when they line up in this configuration, you have to check to this. You can talk about it all you want, but you have to go out and rep it, and everybody has to be on the same page and hear the quarterback do it and see him execute it, you know, and then start to get a feel for where he likes to put the football. If I have a defensive player in this position, I know he's going to back shoulder me, or he's going to high point me, or he's going to do this, or he's going to do that. Those kind of things happen, you know, just over time, you know, getting used to each other and realizing each other's strengths and weaknesses and, you know, proceeding accordingly with how they're going to, you know, play and how they're going to execute against various coverages, various techniques. And, you know, people think it's so simple. You just go out there and, hey, you know, just go out, like out in the backyard. It's pitch and catch. You know, you're just playing catch out there. It's so much different than that. It's, you know, it's a very complicated puzzle that has to be put together for sure.
The NFL is going to have a loss of revenue this year. There's no doubt about that. And that will affect the salary cap next year since it is based on the percentage of revenue. Is that going to impact extensions for A.J. Green and Joe Mixon?
Boy, you know, you have to wonder about that. You know, you look at it and you say, all right, well, there's a massive TV contract that's going to be done here shortly. And that's going to be a huge, huge influx into salary cap. Splitting the revenues, and there's no question about that. But, you know, there is going to be a diminished revenue. There's no question about it if they play without fans. I think right now, no rookies have been signed. No veteran free agents or very few veteran free agents you see signing. I mean, it's an impact on all this. As far as rookies are concerned, you can come to an agreement, but they can't. It's not going to be executed, and they're not going to get any money until they pass a physical. And the same with, you know, with AJ and Joe Mixon. And I mean, there's got to be, the doctors have to get their hands on these guys and make sure there isn't anything that's cropped up, and anything that they've had in their past is not going to be an issue in the future, and all those kind of things before you make those investments. So it's slow. I mean, there's no reason to hurry anything if you can't get your money, you know, until things start to, you know, start to wind back up again. Then when they do start to wind back up again, the second phase is, like you're talking about, is what's the money going to look like? I mean, what are we going to have in terms of our pot? Until we know what the pot is, we're not comfortable dividing it until we know what we've got as a whole, and then we can start giving out pieces of the pie as Paul Brown used to say, and Mike Brown says now, you know, your piece of the pie is this, and it's not going to be any more than that. So until you find out how big that pie is that pie, you know, is that pie just a tiny little, you know, Eskimo pie, or is it a big old pie? What is that pie?
You used to love that piece of the pie discussion in your playing days, didn't you?
Oh, Lordy. I used to have nightmares about that. That phrase would just keep... I'd hear it over and over and over again, just, you know, echoing in the chambers of my empty head. Your piece of the pie is this.
So the NFL talked about it and then elected not to add the option of having a fourth down and 15 play from the 25-yard line as a possibility instead of an onside kick. Do you like that idea?
You know, part of me does like it, but honestly, I mean, I've seen a lot of fourths and 15s. They say the conversion rate is like less than 20%, or maybe, you know, maybe closer to 15%, or even less than that. I don't know. I mean, I've seen a bunch of third and 15s converted, unfortunately, here in the past few years. You know, so fourth and 15, though, it's fourth and 15. It's one down. It's one play. So you don't have to worry about, you know, if you can make a play, that it's all over with. You can defend the sticks and don't let anything get behind you and rally up and try to make a tackle. If you get beaten over the top on a fourth and 15, man, that would be devastation for sure. But I'm sure it would happen. I'm sure it's going to happen. I think they probably feel like the 4th and 15 is too easy. You know, and if you're down a couple of scores, you go, you convert a 4th and 15, and you can get right back in the football game. It's a one score game. I think that's probably their reaction is the onside kick is a tougher thing to convert, but it's a lot more dangerous, you know, and they're trying to eliminate those kind of things. I mean, when you're talking onside kick, been involved in a couple of those over the years. I mean, you talk about a mass of humanity that goes into that pile, you know, full contact. I mean, it's like a mass vehicle accident on the interstate, you know, when everybody's going at the speed limit. I mean, it's there's some serious potential contact in there when everybody's diving for that football, and you can have your foot planted and then your knee mangled in an awkward position. That's the only time I had injuries to my knees was in a pile of people. When you're out in space or you're working, you know, there's nothing inhibiting your lower extremities, you're fine. But when you have a body laying on the ground, and then you're taking over the top of it, and your knee contorts and bends in a way that it's not supposed to, that's when you have these big injuries as linemen, more so than, you know, just like running backs will plant, they'll have non-contact injuries. Linemen, that's more rare. Usually you have injuries when you're gnarled up and part of the mass of humanity is on a big old human beach ball.
Lab, Joe Burrow showed empathy for people in need in his Heisman speech, and he did it again after the murder of George Floyd. He tweeted, "The black community needs our help. Open your ears, listen, and speak. This isn't politics. This is human rights." What did Joe show you when he did that, and what do you think it meant to his teammates?
He showed me, I think, everything that everybody hoped that he's going to be, and I think it meant a lot to his teammates. You know, there's no question about it. I mean, Joe Burrow talked about during his Heisman speech that he grew up in an area where there wasn't a lot of money, you know, and people were trying to figure out how to feed families, you know, white, black, whatever color you're talking about. And so I think he feels like he's got maybe a little bit more empathy, but not like, you know, problems and issues that the black race has had to deal with, you know, during their lifetime and lifetimes of many generations. You know, it's weird, Dan. It's my situation is, I grew up in a town, Wakefield, Massachusetts, was basically white, and we had one black family come to Wakefield when I was in junior high school, and the two kids, Larry and Lewis Roberts, were exceptional people. Not just, you know, I mean, I don't care what race, religion, whatever. I mean, these guys were both highly intelligent, incredibly successful athletically. I mean, my exposure to black people was, I aspired to be Larry Roberts, who was a year ahead of me. He was president of my brother's class, National Honor Society, went to Dartmouth. He was, you know, all state cross country. He played basketball. He was, you know, all league basketball, and then ran track and field. His brother was like that. I mean, that was my exposure. I wanted to be Larry Roberts. I mean, he was my role model. And, you know, and I had some success in high school, and, you know, Larry Roberts graduated in the top 10 of his class. I wanted to graduate in the top 10 of my class, and ended up doing it, and ended up, you know, having an opportunity to go to Ivy League school like Larry Roberts did. And I mean, that was my exposure to, you know, to the black race. And then I go to Syracuse. My freshman year, we have a black boycott. Bench Warswalder, the College Football Hall of Fame head coach, didn't have enough minority members on his coaching staff, and the blacks players decided to boycott. And, you know, I had never been exposed to anything like that, so that was an education process. And we had one black player, Ronnie Page, decided to stay with the team. And, you know, I got to be pretty good friends with Ronnie Page, and how courageous that guy was, and, you know, all the things that he had to deal with. And then I saw all the racial unrest in Syracuse, and I was part of some things that were very, very ugly. Witnessed some things, and one of our quarterbacks, who was a good high school basketball player, went down to the down to the basketball courts in the city to play pickup basketball, and he was the only white player on the court, and he got in a situation where he was beaten up, and they had to reconstruct his face, put the other cheekbones by surgery up through his mouth. I mean, he saw some unbelievable stuff. So, you know, I start out in one way and then kind of get educated the other, and then come to the National Football League and have teammates like Archie Griffin, Isaac Curtis. I mean, these guys, if I had no family members to raise my kids, if something happened to me, I'd want those guys to raise my kids. I mean, just unbelievable people, you know, and Vernon Holland, who I played next to in the offensive line. We got to be so close. When he turned 30 years old, he invited me to his party. I was the only white person at this party. And he was taking me around to his friends and family members like I was a family member. You know, and it's been an up and down big range of experiences and education in terms of, you know, racism or lack thereof, or understanding the differences, and there are huge differences. I mean, until you've walked in the shoes of somebody that has had to deal with all the things that, you know, some of these black people have had to deal with their entire lives and multiple generations, you don't have a reference point. But all I can say is my experiences over the years have been they're unbelievable white people, you know, just role model white people, and they're jerks. They're unbelievable people, role model black people, and they're jerks. And I don't care what color they are. They're good people, and they're bad people. And what we have to do is just try to understand each other's plights a little bit, you know, and because I've got a granddaughter who has, one of her best friends in her class in school, preschool, is a young black kid, and she loves the guy. So I mean, it's all about experiences. Right now, it's pristine. She has no, you know, there's no opinions trying to sway her one way or the other, and that's the way. So you start out that way. Don't get poisoned, and if you do have bad experiences, hope that you're going to have some good experiences, you know, so you can understand the total picture. And man, I tell you, it's just a matter of everybody trying to understand, you know, the other person's plight, the other person's problems, you know, like Rodney King said so many years ago, can't we all just get along? I mean, that sums the whole thing up in a nutshell.
Open your ears, listen and speak. I thought that was, that was perfect from Joe Burrow.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, no doubt.
Let's get to some Ask Lap questions that were submitted on Twitter. We start with JoJo Jammer. Here's his question. Over the years, what rule change has helped offensive linemen the most?
Oh, being able to use your hands. You know, extend your arms and use your hands. You know, you can lock your arms out, and as long as you're inside the framework of the body as such, you can't put your arms around defensive players and bear hug them. But you know, you can even grab cloth if you're inside the framework of the body of the person you're trying to block. And I mean, I've been in both sides of that. When I first started playing, it was you had to keep your hands and you had to keep them by your chest, and you could throw a forearm type thing, but you could never extend your arms and open your hands and grab people. There's no way any of that could happen. We were human punching bags. There's no question about it. Defensive players could head slap. They could do everything. I mean, they just tee off on you, and you know, you're just an instrument to absorb, you know, punishment. It was crazy. Now, allowing offensive linemen to do that, I think it has changed the game unbelievably, because part of the reason that it's a better passing. It's a passing game now is because offensive linemen can pass protect so much easier. You can do so much more in terms of trying to, prevent defensive players from getting your quarterback in a heartbeat. And that allows the field to open up. And so I think that was a major, major rule change, big time.
Question from Lockie, who does not have the glass half full based on this question. If, God forbid, Joe Burrow suffers a season-ending injury, and the Bengals earn the number one overall draft pick again, would they take Trevor Lawrence or trade down?
Wow.
It's not going to happen, Lockie. Don't worry, buddy.
Lockie, that is about as dark as it gets. Man, have an adult beverage. Loosen up a little bit, my man. Oh, goodness. That's something. I don't even want to think about that. That would be tragic, you know, but it's funny, not funny, it's sad, really. I mean, Kenny Anderson got his opportunity because Greg Cook, who was going to be the greatest quarterback in Bengals history, if not amongst best in NFL history, out of University of Cincinnati, you know, I mean, this guy was a freak athlete, and he had that terrible shoulder injury, and then eventually they drafted Ken Anderson. So, I mean, it happens. Unfortunately, it happens. You do have injuries. I hate to think about career-ending injuries, but you do have injuries that are going to put people on a shelf. I mean, that would be, you know, something that you certainly don't want to contemplate happening after you draft somebody, you know, the first pick in the entire draft. It would have to be, I think, for them to go quarterback again, it would have to be a debilitating, almost career-ending injury. And we're not talking about somebody who's drafted in the top 10. You know, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about like what happened in Arizona, where they draft a quarterback in the top 10, and then, you know, he's traded away, and then they draft a quarterback number one in Kyler Murray. So it's not. We're not talking about that type of situation. I think the odds are infinitesimally small.
Not going to happen, Lockie. Don't worry about it, buddy.
Yep.
From Cornelius, who is up to battle for the kicker job, or do the Bengals think they're set? There are no other kickers on the roster right now, so that would seem to indicate they're set, right?
Yeah, I think they're pretty well set. I think they're they feel like they've got people that they can count on in terms of getting things done when the pressure's on and trying to, you know, make a big play to win a football game. And I know they like every phase of it. You know, Harris is a snapper, has been to the Pro Bowl. Huber's a punter, has been to the Pro Bowl. They don't have a Pro Bowl place kicker, but, you know, they feel like they've got somebody that can handle the task for sure. I think, again, with the coronavirus, though, I mean, everything is so stalled. You know, I don't think there's any rush to do anything right now. And honestly, like we were talking about earlier, it would not shock me if a ton of teams around the league end up having far fewer than 90 players. You know, 90 is the number that the NFL allows to come to camp. It would not stun me if teams have fewer players than that, you know, in training camp. It would not stun me whatsoever. And you know, how do you give a kicker, you want to look at him for a long period of time. You want to set up as many multiple competitions as you can to see, you know, who is the guy. Well, you haven't had time to do that. And I don't know. I mean, this is such an unusual year in terms of evaluating players. If you are somebody looking to earn a spot somewhere in some way, shape, or form, whatever that may be, this might be the toughest year to try to get that done. If you're established, you might feel a little bit more comfortable. But if you're not, man, it's a tough year to try to start a career out when you're totally unestablished and you're not a high draft pick and you're not a sought-after veteran free agent. I mean, it's a very, very tough year for that for sure.
Question from Scott. Is the current offensive line personnel good enough to protect Joe Burrow and allow him to have a season comparable to Andy Dalton and A.J. Green's rookie year?
Well, the one commonality that hopefully he has is a healthy A.J. Green. And, you know, not a rookie A.J. Green. Joe Burrow will have an A.J. Green that was a perennial Pro Bowl player when healthy and has proven himself to be, you know, among the top, worst-case scenario when healthy, top five, top handful, maybe top three, you know, when totally healthy in the NFL. So that would be a huge advantage for Joe Burrow. And Joe Burrow, I think there's a lot of similarities and with the learning capacities and mindsets and mentalities of Joe Burrow and Andy Dalton, I think in a very, very positive way. So the question is, you know, Joe Burrow is going to know what he's looking at. He's going to know where to throw the football, how to throw the football, and when to throw the football. And, you know, he's going to get them out of bad plays into better plays. The key component is, will the offensive line give him time to operate, give him time to do all those things? And that's the million-dollar question. I think potentially, you know, there are some guys up there that have skill sets. You know, Jonah Williams, from what I'm watching him on tape in college, he's got a great skill set. And it's at the SEC level, which is the highest level you can face in college football, but it's not the National Football League. And, you know, there have been, I don't want to be Debbie Downer, but I've seen many first-round draft picks not be able to cut the mustard. I've seen many first-round draft picks able to cut the mustard. So I think he'll cut the mustard. You know, I think Michael Jordan has untapped potential. Trey Hopkins got himself an extension and earned it and deserved it. Physically and mentally, he's a hell of a football player. Suofilo, is got some NFL experience. But when you have 40% of your offensive line has not taken a snap as a Cincinnati Bengal, and Michael Jordan's snaps are, you know, minimal, Bobby Hart at right tackle, Fred Johnson in a fight there, Isaiah Prince, I mean, they've got bodies, they've got people. The question is, like we talked about earlier, will they play like a fist? Will they play as one? Will they play cohesive? Will they play as a unit? I mean, you know, I always like to use this number. Offensive line play can be summed up like this. You throw the ball 20 times in a game. You're an offensive lineman. You block your guy 19 times out of 20. He beats you once, maybe for a pressure, hopefully not a sack, but you grade 95. Everybody in the offensive line blocks their guy 19 times out of 20, and they all grade an A, 95. Problem is, they all get beaten on different snaps. So instead of grading 95 as a group, you grade 75. Five of the 20 times you were beaten as a group. So you grade a C. So individually, everybody, man, I had a game. I got my chest pumped out. You know, I blocked my guy. I blocked at an A level. Yeah, well, we all did, but the quarterback had hit five times. And as a group, you guys were, to me, that is the epitome of teamwork. The offensive line is the epitome of teamwork. And until those guys prove that they can, you know, work together like that, and make all the components, when you add everybody's talents and abilities up, you have, you know, a synergistic effect. 1 + 1 = 3, not just 2, because they're playing so well together. And they can hide each other's, if there's weakness, they can figure out a way to hide it by making a call and giving some help here, doing whatever. That's the key to offensive line play. It's how are you performing as a unit? How are you performing as a group?
One more follow-up to that last question. Andy Dalton obviously led the Bengals to nine wins his rookie year and a spot in the playoffs, but statistically, he wasn't great as a rookie. He was good, 20 touchdown passes, 13 picks, passer rating of 80.4, but just in following up on that last question, I think Joe Burrow stands a very good chance of surpassing those numbers. The hard part will be matching the nine wins. All right, question from Brian Mon and others. Why not make a run at free agent offensive lineman Larry Warford, the three-time Pro Bowler out of UK who was recently released by the Saints?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of people that are trying to determine around the league, trying to determine whether they make a run at him or not. I think part of it right now is economics. You know, that's why he's not a New Orleans Saint anymore. And the Bengals are, like we're talking about, not only trying to sign all their rookies, and you know what you're spending from a cap standpoint there. I mean, everything is, you know, is basically predetermined. The Bengals know exactly what they have to spend on rookies based on the number that they drafted, you know, seven. I mean, New England drafted 14. They know what they have to spend. The Bengals know what they have to spend. It's all predicated on slotted where they're drafted. And Bengals have some high draft picks every round, so they're going to be spending some money on their rookies in their salary cap. They have to just eat to, and then you want to extend AJ Green, you want to extend Joe Mixon. You know, it's where are your priorities, and how far along are you in the process of all those things, and what might be left over, and then you make a determination based on, you know, how many people are competing for the services of Warford. Where's that contract going to end up? And I'll guarantee you, it's been discussed. There's not one of the obviously the Saints made their decision. 31 other teams, they all have to decide. The Saints have decided, but maybe not. Maybe if Warford is out there and there's not the dollars out there that he thinks, maybe he may come back to the Saints and say, "What about this?" And maybe the Saints say, "Hell yeah." So, I mean, there's a lot to play out in terms of what's going on with him. And there's no way in my mind the Bengals haven't kicked the tires, you know, thought about that that process. But there's a lot of variables in the equation, and you know that's the way it is with a lot of teams around the league. On top of it being, you know, the coronavirus, and you can't get your hands on him and give him a physical and all the things. I mean, he's played a lot of snaps in the National Football League at this stage, and so you want to make sure that that there are no surprises there physically as well. So, you know, it's all a slow process.
He reportedly wants $7 million a year. He's a big man, 330 pounds plus. And I read one story out of a New Orleans outlet that said there was a significant drop-off in his play last year, even though he was a Pro Bowler, and he had weight and conditioning issues. So I don't know if that's true. I haven't studied it enough, but I did read that, and I wonder, based on that, if you've really got to get your hands on that guy before you commit that kind of money.
Well, if he and that does happen. Guys will decline and still make the Pro Bowl based on reputation. You know, sometimes it becomes a popularity contest, and it doesn't catch up with a guy till he, you know, he has another year that's not maybe as good as it was when he was a Pro Bowler. And if he had weight and conditioning problems last year, this year with the coronavirus, and you have to be a self-starter in terms of working out and finding a place to work out, and you have to really commit yourself to your profession, and he had problems last year in that regard, boy, he'd be radioactive until I can at least see him. You know, and see, you know, is he a hot mess, or is he in some kind of, you know, a modicum of condition that you can work with? Where, yeah, he might be able to get back to playing at his form, his prior form. You know, maybe he had a wake up call and he's in great shape, or maybe, you know, he's down in the dumps because of what happened last year and he's in worse shape, and you don't know until you work him out and you see him.
Right. All right. Question from Matthew. With Burrow's accuracy, do you see pass catchers, especially wide receivers, having an easier time boosting stats? This question comes from Matthew Heitzman, not fantasy football guru Matthew Berry, because it sounds sounds kind of like somebody who's interested in those fantasy numbers for the Bengals wide receivers in the Joe Burrow era.
You know, I do think that the quarterbacks that have uncanny accuracy can improve the numbers for their receivers on a yards per catch basis, total yards as a result of that, and everything goes along with it, because there's completions and then there's completions. By that I mean, okay, you can put the ball on him and complete it, and you make him stop to make the catch and he's tackled. Or I'm talking about a guy that's on a slant and he's running open, but you make him stop to catch the football and he gets immediately killed. Or a guy that's on a slant, he's open, and you lead him where he doesn't break stride. He catches the football, and he's in full stride when he catches it, and he takes it for a 70-yard touchdown, a la John Ross did when he went up to see him up the gut, you know, and scored. So quarterbacks that have that uncanny, innate ability to put it to spots where, you know, the receiver can catch the football in full stride, those are the guys that are gold. And I think Joe Burrow does have that ability. I think he showed that kind of ability, you know, at LSU. The other thing, you know, simple, you see completions where the quarterback makes the receiver work too hard and he falls to the ground. You know, in college, they're down. Now, you can get back up and run in the NFL, but hell, if you're on the ground, you ain't getting up and running too far in the NFL. You're going to get destroyed. You're going to get smoked while you're on the ground, probably. So you want to keep people on their feet, and if possible, you want to hit them in stride. And that's where numbers increase for receivers and quarterbacks that can, you know, execute that type of a completion accuracy. Those are the ones that are, you know, amongst the best in the league for sure.
Question from Big Mike. What's the plan for Billy Price? Is he going to compete for a starting spot, or is it safe to say he's going to be a backup?
Well, I think everybody – the one thing that that I will say, the offensive line coach's mindset is it's meritocracy. I mean, if you earn the job, you're going to get the job. And that's why, I mean, you have to pencil somebody in as a starting line, as a starter in your line. And I do think, you know, the starting five would probably be Jonah Williams at left tackle, Michael Jordan at left guard, Trey Hopkins at center, Xavier Suafilo at right guard, and Bobby Hart initially at right tackle. And then compete. Best man wins. So I don't think that Billy Price is necessarily penciled in as a starter. But, you know, if he has a very strong performance, now we're talking about a potentially shortened training camp. But if he goes out and performs well in preseason games, performs well in the early stages of regular season games, and, you know, if guys, good line coaches that I play for, if guys have shown that they can play, you might have seven guys. You may have seven guys that you feel like could start. Rotate them. I mean, you rotate defensive linemen. Why the hell not rotate offensive linemen? You're rotating defensive linemen to keep them fresh. You can play more than, you know, five offensive linemen if you feel like you're not going to drop off in terms of performance, and keep guys fresh and play guys at multiple positions. And, you know, I experienced that. I mean, the more positions you can play, the more valuable you are. And, you know, Billy Price, if he shows he's equally effective at center, right, left, right, or left guard, he's got some value. You know, and if he shows he should get some snaps, give him some snaps. So, and I'm not talking about every other series. You know, I'm talking about, you know, maybe rolling a guy in there period just to keep him sharp, and you know, and to keep other guys fresh. And so, I mean, in a perfect world, you've got eight offensive linemen that you really like. I mean, there's a whisker difference between the talents and the performance potential production, you know, of all of them. And then it starts to get into the other things, the intelligence factor. Coaches are confident with smart players. If you have a guy that is, you know, 100% guy, never makes any mental mistakes, that's a tiebreaker now. That's a tiebreaker. So there are a lot of things you evaluate, but you don't want to have just five starting offensive linemen. You want to have, you know, seven or eight if you possibly can.
All right, final Ask Lap question. This one comes from Jim, and I'm shocked that I have never asked you this question. Here goes. What's the most you ever benched, squatted, and deadlifted?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was in the era of Nautilus. With the Bengals, we didn't use free weights. So, and at Syracuse, I mean, at the most I benched was 410. I can't remember what I squatted. I think, you know, it got to the point where they were very, very nervous about, you know, letting you load up and squatting ridiculous amount of weights to max. And so we would use, you know, significant amount of weight and try to rep that weight in terms of squatting and deadlifting, man. You know, I never did deadlift either, you know, being in that era that I was in. But I will say one thing. I work construction, concrete forms, and you know, I remember picking up some concrete forms that had, you know, dried concrete in them. And you pick them up off the ground, and it's like, I don't know how much it weighed, but, boy, that was a big old deadlift. Hmm. And I remember ones that weren't quite as filled with as much concrete, you know, sticking, you know, pressing them over my head. And I was trying to get a workout doing the construction job, you know, kind of curling some of these concrete forms if I could grab them well enough. And then I also moved furniture as well. Did the construction job move furniture. And I remember, you know, taking a refrigerator, putting it on my back with a strap, and going up three flights of stairs to an apartment and delivering a refrigerator.
That's a squat.
That was a. I remember my legs were quivering, man. Oof. I got to that third floor and I was like, whoa! Put that thing down, and my legs were like shaking. But that was, you know, that was great work. So, Kim Wood was the strength coach, and he and Pete Brown were partners in Nautilus, and the Bengals were huge Nautilus disciples. That's what we worked out with mostly.
Well, your 410 bench press is currently the lead in the Bengals booth. You've got me beat for now, but now I have a target.
Gotcha, coach.
If I can double my all-time high, I have a chance. All right. You're off the hot seat. Appreciate the information as always. Hope to see you soon.
All right, Dan the Man. Have a great one.
Here's one final note before we wrap things up. As I mentioned earlier, I'm recording this on Friday, June 5th. And tonight, at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, NBC Sports Network is airing Super Bowl 23 in its entirety. I plan to watch before turning it off after Jim Breach's game-winning field goal with 3:20 to go. In my family room tonight, there will be no such thing as Montana to Taylor. That's going to do it for this episode of the Bengals Booth Podcast, brought to you by Prime Sport, the official fan travel and hospitality partner of the Cincinnati Bengals. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, and if you have a minute, give it a rating or share a comment. That helps more Bengals fans find this podcast. I'm Dan Horde, and thanks for listening to the Bengals Booth Podcast.